You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new organization is trying to raise the number of Latinx people going into medical careers in Wisconsin. We'll talk to the group's founding president about their goals and how they're going to try to achieve them. Now, you may have tried foraging in Wisconsin, maybe picking blackberries or apples or morel mushrooms. But what about eating only what you can forage? For 1 month, Wisconsin-based climate activist and humanitarian Rob Greenfield is doing that. From the forest to city parks, Rob is eating only what he can forage on a trip between New York and Wisconsin. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me in, Rob. It's really great to be here.
What got you into serious foraging in the first place?
Well, I actually grew up in northern Wisconsin on Lake Superior and Ashland, and I have to say for the first 20 years of my life, I loved the outdoors. I fished and all of that, but I never paid any attention to the plants. My food came from the grocery store. And about 10 years ago, I started to watch a lot of documentaries and read a lot of books and just started to learn that the way that I was living was causing a lot of destruction. And I largely learned about our food system, how destructive our food system is. And one of the ways that I reconnected to my food was realizing that it's growing freely and abundantly all around me.
Now, you started this current project, I think, on September 9th. Tell us what you are doing.
Yeah, so today is day 10 of 1 month of foraging 100% of my food. So for the whole month, no grocery stores or restaurants, nothing packaged or processed. Even my medicine is coming from nature. And no gardens either. It's food that is growing in the wild. And that can mean like deep in the wild on the Wisconsin River or in the woods, or that can mean abandoned lots in the city here in Madison.
And so it's only stuff you've picked, not like food waste or dumpster diving or things like that, though I think you have some interest in that too.
Yes.
Just stuff you're picking up out of the ground growing more or less wild.
Yeah, the ground or the sky, depending on where it's growing. But yeah, a lot of people know me for my food waste activism. I've done Food Waste Fiasco here in Madison and I've shown that I've dived into thousands of grocery store dumpsters across the country. Some people call that urban foraging, but for this month, no dumpsters. I'm showing that we can exist completely independently from the global industrial food system and that this food is growing freely and abundantly everywhere we go.
Now, I got to be honest, one problem I would have with this is I'm very bad at telling one plant from another. How do you make sure you're eating stuff that you ought to be eating?
Yes. So there's one simple rule to foraging to not die and get sick. And it's simply don't eat something unless you're completely sure of what it is. So the key with safe foraging is you start with really easy things. Start with the plants that are easy to identify. One great thing to do is get out with a local forager. Here in Madison area, there's a group called What Got Gathered. His name's Andy, and he takes people out on foraging walks. So going out with a forager is an excellent way to get started.
Okay, so what have you mainly been living on this first, where you said 10 days of the project?
Yeah, well, wild rice has been one of my main food sources. We are so blessed in Wisconsin to have wild rice. Manomin, the food that grows on water, growing in abundance. Lots of venison, which I actually harvest deer that have been hit by cars, which is, you know, kind of a shocker for some people. Lots of apples. I make a lot of applesauce, and then tons of berries like aronia and choke cherries and wild grapes. Lots of nutritious and delicious greens like stinging nettle and sochan and watercress and dandelion. And then lots of herbal teas, things like elderberry and goldenrod for things like this. And of course, lots of mushrooms.
Now, you've picked a pretty abundant time of year. Is this something we really could live on year round, even like, winter in northern Wisconsin?
Yes, actually, this is kind of my second big project in this way. In 2019, I did a year where I grew and foraged all of my food, but that included the garden. And on that trip, I actually came up here to Wisconsin and I saw the bounty up here unlike anywhere I'd ever seen before. We have such a bounty of food growing. The key for anyone who is interested in living, you know, completely off the land, as someone would say, is to harvest that bounty throughout the summer and fall and then store that bounty through the winter. So it is possible to live solely off the food of Wisconsin if desired.
Talking to Rob Greenfield about his foraging. He is living for a month right now. only eating foraged food, as he mentioned, from a forest or maybe a parking lot. What, when you talk to people about this, Rob, what are people most surprised about? Like, really? You can eat that?
Yeah, I think people are surprised at just how much food is growing around us. Whether, again, it's, you know, in your sort of deep wilderness, or it's right on the sidewalks, it's the weeds in our front yard, it's the fruit trees growing, you know, along the sidewalks. People are amazed at how food is just growing everywhere. And I was just out for the last 5 hours around Madison, and today I harvested, you know, maitake, which is also called hen of the woods, and all sorts of different greens like nettle and watercress, and herbs like bee balm and wild onions galore. So people are amazed about that. And then I think people are also amazed that actually so much out there is actually edible. A lot of people are taught to, you know, be afraid of everything. You don't have to be afraid of everything as long as you're, you know, paying attention and opening your eyes.
Now, not everybody is going to do something like this, forage only for a month. But with this project and your bigger project, the Regeneration Equity and Justice, I think it's called, what are some of the things you hope people take away from this?
Sure. Yeah. For me, I take on sort of extreme projects that are designed to capture people's attention, to take them along on the journey with me. But the goal is not that anybody has to do this. The goal is to think about our current food system. Our current food system is incredibly destructive. With most bites on our plate, we're taking a bite from the planet. And I am trying to, you know, just show people that other ways are possible, that we can connect to food through foraging. We can connect to food through supporting our local farmers, going to the local farmers market, through growing some of our own food. And none of this has to be alone. We can do this together in community, and this can be enjoyable and fun while regenerating our earth.
Okay, and I got to ask, you're eating a lot of foods that you foraged, obviously. What's your favorite one they're eating? What is like the tastiest thing you're eating this month?
The tastiest thing. Wow. Well, I would say at this, whatever's tastiest is whatever I'm thinking about in the moment. Today I harvested a lot of aronia. So I'm going to be making aronia juice, and I love that. And wild rice. I mean, I crave wild rice, and of course, applesauce. But actually, what I'm really excited to hopefully find on my trip to New York City, which, you know, over the next 3 weeks, I'll be leading these plant walks from, you know, in Chicago and Cincinnati, Boston, Providence, New Haven, and along the way. And I'm really excited to find pawpaw, because that's a new one for me.
Pawpaw?
Pawpaw.
I hear that. I think it's a tropical thing. What is it really?
People think it's tropical, but it's a native plant. Now, it actually doesn't grow in Wisconsin, but I'm going to be in Ohio in just a couple of days, so that's where I'll get into that.
All right, Rob, thanks a lot for sharing your project with us.
My pleasure. And if anybody wants to join all across the country, my website is just robgreenfield.org/reconnect. And that has all the information and tour dates. And you can join me on social media, where I'm posting fun ways to get involved.
That's Rob Greenfield, a Wisconsin-based activist. For 1 month, Rob is foraging for all of his food, from forests to city parks. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a preview of a new WPR podcast launching today. It's called Uprooted, exploring the lives of Cubans in Wisconsin.
Imagine, you're a 16-year-old kid thousands of miles from home. You've just stepped off a plane in Wisconsin. For the next few months, you'll be living at an army base. There are strangers, people who don't speak your language. It feels like you're living in prison. Your whole world has been uprooted. You think you're alone, far from family and friends, when suddenly you discover your father, who you've barely had a relationship with, is also at this military base in Wisconsin. This was the reality for Armando Rodriguez, who left his barracks at Fort McCoy daily to meet with his father, Guillermo Rodriguez.
Yo veía a mi papá del lado allá.
I saw my dad on the other side of the fence, and we talked from afar. And we spent about a month and some like that.
Armando and Guillermo are from Cuba and had to live at Fort McCoy until they found a home in the United States. They were here in Sparta, Wisconsin, because of the Mariel boatlift. For 5 months in 1980, the Cuban government opened its borders and let its residents leave for the U.S. during the height of the Cold War. Almost 125,000 Cubans fled the island and landed in South Florida by boat.
She says more craft are expected to make the journey in what could build into a Dunkirk-like evacuation.
Because of that, the president yesterday declared a state of emergency in southern Florida.
There's a hopeful feeling that they will be allowed to stay in this country and to find jobs.
Many refugees left their homeland to find a better opportunity or escape Fidel Castro's communist government. Some wanted to be reunited with family. Others were plucked from jail and pushed onto boats.
We arrived here in Key West, and then we arrived at Fort McCoy. In Fort McCoy, I stayed for 5 months.
Armando was one of the nearly 15,000 people sent to Fort McCoy in Wisconsin before he found a home. Most of the Cubans who came to Wisconsin left the area after connecting with family or finding sponsors. But some people, like Armando, remained in southern Wisconsin. They created lives here as bus drivers, fathers, and musicians. Now, 42 years later, many of the refugees want to visit Cuba. People like Armando want to go just one more time, but they can't.
I've never been able to visit Cuba. I would like to visit Cuba. I'm not allowed to go. And if I go, I can't come back. I am in the same situation as everyone else who has committed a crime.
His friends in Wisconsin feel the same.
I'm 63 years old. Wow, times go fast, you know. And I haven't given up. I have faith.
The immigration, you know, give us a second chance. Why can those Cubans get a second chance?
Do you want to go back and visit also?
Yeah, I want to go see my mama before she died.
I can go to Cuba.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, I can go. Because I was lucky. I never committed a crime. The only problem is when I want to do my passport, I talk to my sister to send my birth certificate. And when I see my birth certificate, that's wrong. That's not my name.
Because when I tried to kill him, I always say, you know, the reason I did it because I want to go back to Cuba.
I'm Maureen McCollum, and this is Uprooted, a new podcast from Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll hear from Cuban Wisconsinites who arrived here more than 40 years ago. These are the unheard voices behind the headlines. What were their lives like in Cuba? What was the journey like across the sea? What has life been like in Wisconsin? And after 40 years, where do they go from here? Subscribe to Uprooted wherever you get your podcasts, and you can see more at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we talk about the need for more Latinx medical professionals in Wisconsin and how a new organization is working to address that problem. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Now, a new Wisconsin organization is aiming to increase Latinx representation in medical professions. The Medical Organization for Latino Advancement, or MOLA, first started in Chicago in 2017. Now there's a chapter operating in Wisconsin. Dr. Patricia Tellez-Giron is an associate professor in the UW-Madison Department of Family Medicine and Community Health. She's chair of the Latino Health Council of Dane County, and she's founding president of the Wisconsin chapter of MOLA. Dr. Tellez-Giron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about why you are tackling this problem? How do we see people of Latina backgrounds underrepresented in medicine?
Well, we know that the Latinx community is the fastest growing in the United States. And even though we are about 19%, the representation of health professionals is only like 3-4%. So we definitely need to increase the representation to be able to serve the fastest growing population.
What does it mean if people of Latinx backgrounds are underrepresented in medicine? How does that, first of all, affect patients?
Well, research has shown that when you have a healthcare provider that looks like you, that understands your language, your cultural background, your health outcomes are going to be better. So if we don't increase the representation, we're going to continue having health disparities that have been in existence for many years.
Now, this group is new in Wisconsin, but I understand you've been working to be a mentor to try to bring people into medical fields for quite a while now. What are some of the things you and your colleagues have been doing already?
Yeah, many years ago, we recognized that we needed to start somewhere and that it takes many years to grow a healthcare provider. So we started pairing up with pre-med students here at the university with a group that is called PALMA, Professional Association for Latinos for Medical School Access. And we started helping them with clinical shadowing experiences, community work, and mentoring. What we realized is that many times our students need a lot of coaching, a lot of support, a lot of sharing, like, yes, you can do this, don't let anybody else tell you that you can do that. Many times they come from backgrounds that are very difficult, families that are undocumented, poor, first generation college students, and we really need to help them get to the place where they need to be to help our communities.
Yeah, becoming a doctor is a lot of work to begin with. Can you talk about a little more about some of the additional hurdles that some of the younger students you're working with are facing?
Yes. So many of our students, even though they were born in the United States, they are raised by families that speak only Spanish. So that could be a big, big problem. Being first generation students here in the United States, the families do not know the system or how to help them get to sometimes even high school or higher education. Racism is definitely one, and discrimination is one that really gets on the way, and resources, because they come from families that are poor. And to go to medical school, it takes a lot of money through the years of pre-med and then through medical school. So lots of different factors.
We're talking to Dr. Patricia Tellez-Giron, Associate Professor in the UW-Madison Department of Family Medicine and Community Health, about this new chapter of an organization called the Medical Organization for Latino Advancement here in Wisconsin. Dr. Tellez-Giron, let's talk about this group now. You've got this chapter in Wisconsin. What is the focus? What kind of things will you be working on?
So the collaboration with the mother organization, MOLA, in Chicago, started exactly because we realized that in Wisconsin, we did not have anything like it. We look at what they are offering, and they are offering mentorship, they are offering education and research, well-being experiences, advocacy, public health. So eventually we want to try to offer the same thing to our membership. We are starting with mentoring, which is what we have been doing now for several years, as you presented before. And then from there, we're going to try to grow and offer the same benefits that MOLA Chicago is offering their members. For now, by pairing with MOLA Chicago, we can offer our membership the same services through them.
Now, how about people who aren't in pre-med programs yet? What would you do, or what do you think could be done to encourage people, you know, in the high school level or maybe even lower, to start thinking, well, I don't see doctors who look like me, but maybe I can be a doctor?
Yes, and we have been doing that as well. It's kind of similar to what we call a ladder program. So what we do, we have our pre-med students work with the high schoolers, and then from there, the medical school, the medical students work with the pre-med, and then the residents work with the medical students, and so on. And now here in Madison, the district has started a path for health. So we're going to try to pair up with them too. And they start from high school, in the very beginning of high school, and sometimes even in middle school. So yes, and we want to increase the representation again, so that when the families go to the doctor and the kids see a doctor that looks like them, that speaks like them, that they say, you know, I can be one of them. So, but for that, we need more of us.
At one point, of course, you were a pre-med student, Dr. Tejas-Giron. What kind of lessons did you take from your experience then that you're hoping to share with new generations?
Well, I actually did my medical school in Mexico, so it was a little bit different. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of support and a lot of people that looked like me, but thanks to that experience, when I moved to the United States and I had to basically start over, I realized the needs that our students have in here and the difference of how the resources have to be targeted in a different way to our students. And thanks to that is that I can talk to my pre-med students and tell them all the requirements that are needed, and not only talk to them about the requirements that are needed, but give them those requirements. So I give them experiences in the clinic with shadowing. They work with us in the community. And then I basically become kind of their mother. I call them my chickens because I help them with anything that they need. And I have other team members that also do.
And briefly, as we wrap up, if somebody out there is listening is saying, hey, yeah, you're talking about me, I'm going or hoping to go into pre-med or I'm in pre-med, where would you point them toward to get more information?
Definitely MOLA, M-O-L-A. So go and become a member. And then through that, we can reach out to you and see what your needs are and start helping you. So when you go to MOLA, you say MOLA Wisconsin and register. It's actually free. Right now for students to sign in.
Dr. Tejas-Giron, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Patricia Tejas-Giron, Associate Professor in the UW-Madison Department of Family Medicine and Community Health. We talked to her today about a new Wisconsin chapter of the group Medical Organization for Latino Advancement, which she helped found here in the state. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, from pumpkin spice to dumbphone, new words and phrases are entering the dictionary. Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett from Away With Words are back with us for a look at the origins of words and how they enter common use in a language. And should downtown communities provide free parking? A city planning expert says convenient free parking often comes at an unreasonable cost to communities. That's more, that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then Republican governors from some southern states are busing or flying migrants to northern cities controlled by Democrats. We'll talk about the tactic, its impact, and questions about its legality. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new public opinion project aims to measure what issues are most important to Wisconsin voters in the upcoming election. We'll talk to one of the organizers about the Main Street Agenda and its upcoming town hall events around the state. First, Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis claimed credit last week for flying about 50 mostly Venezuelan migrants to Martha's Vineyard, a small vacation island in Massachusetts. Republican governors in states like Texas and Arizona have been using the tactic for months, busing or flying migrants to northern cities, mostly under the leadership of Democrats. But immigrants' rights advocates and Democrats have called the practice cruel and possibly illegal, with some saying it could amount to human trafficking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this move by some governors of states in the South? Do you think the U.S. needs to change its strategy on the southern border? What would you change about the immigration system if you could? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Elise, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you, Rob.
Before we dig into some of the specifics, Elise, what's been your reaction as you see these reports of migrants from Venezuela and elsewhere being bused or flown to cities often unprepared for their arrival?
Yeah, that's a great point you raise about the lack of advance notice here. So I think if it were really about addressing the policy problem of the influx of migrants along the southern border, we wouldn't see the lack of coordination ahead of transporting the migrants, which that alone sort of suggests it's not really about addressing the policy problem, but more about messaging and symbolic politics, even sort of picking up on the urban-rural divide, since a lot of these Democratic-leaning so-called sanctuary areas are in much more urban centers in the country.
I want to give a listen to Florida Governor DeSantis talking last night at a Republican campaign event in Green Bay. Here's what he had to say about the migrants that Florida sent to Martha's Vineyard last week.
They said they're a sanctuary city. They say that nobody, no human being is illegal. Everyone's welcome. So this is a place, there's jobs available, there's hotels and Airbnb available. And honestly, these were folks who got the transport that Biden totally abandoned. They were homeless. They were hungry. So they hit the jackpot to be able to be in the wealthiest sanctuary jurisdiction in the world.
Elise, you mentioned the political symbolism there. Do you think there's a case to be made, as Governor DeSantis is claiming, that, well, maybe the people who were sent to Martha's Vineyard were better off?
Yeah, it's interesting because you could hear the way he was cueing the crowd to cheer when he was talking about the idea that these are very wealthy enclaves. And we also saw, by the way, in the past fall, Senator Ted Cruz introduced federal legislation that was advocating something very similar, the Stop the Surge Act, as he called it, to relocate migrants in the southern border to Democratic-leaning enclaves. And when he was doing press releases on that, he gave speeches very similar to what you just played in that clip, where he was saying, you know, these are the places that Democratic elites hold their cocktail parties. So there's really this partisan antagonism. There's this sort of mocking aspect to it that seems to go beyond just what's best for the interests of the migrants or what's best for relocating them to places where they'll have more services available.
Who are we talking about here? Who are the migrants who are being relocated by bus or plane here?
Well, what's interesting with this case is, unlike the past couple of years where we've seen the majority of migrants crossing from Central America and the Northern Triangle countries, we have a lot more now from Venezuela and from Cuba. So there's been kind of a change in the who. We also see a lot more single adults, still a lot of families and children. But in Venezuela, the crisis has become so severe. It's being termed one of the worst peacetime crises in the past 100 years, perhaps even on par or worse than the Great Depression in the United States. So that can help us understand why so many people have left Venezuela. There's water shortages, food scarcity, constant power blackouts, and not even access to medical care or basic medicines. And we saw that around 94% of Venezuelans last year were falling into poverty levels, which is just a really unprecedented level of poverty in the country. So that can sort of help us understand why the majority in this group is coming from Venezuela.
Let's talk about asylum seekers now. I believe some of the people who were transported fall into that category. Can you talk about the sort of legal protections someone who's claiming asylum here in the U.S. does and doesn't have?
Absolutely. Asylum is a legal right, and it's protected not only under international law, but also under U.S. law. So these migrants, many of them have filed for asylum, and they have been released legally from federal immigration authorities as they await their asylum cases. And part of asylum law is that there's freedom of movement. And so what that means is these asylum seekers need to periodically check in with federal immigration authorities, like a local ICE agent, for example, but they are permitted to travel throughout the U.S. There's nothing that would require them to be in a certain jurisdiction, particularly just based on, you know, partisanship or that it's a liberal-leaning jurisdiction.
We're talking to Elise Cohen, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW Green Bay, looking at migrants in the U.S. Being transported by bus or plane to northern cities coming from places like Texas, or being transported by Florida or Arizona. You could join in with your reactions to this story, your questions about it, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. At least the basic notion, if it was maybe being done in an organized way, of arranging different places around the country for migrants who are maybe waiting for their processing of their asylum request, is that such a bad idea? Should we be spreading people out around the country instead of concentrating them more toward the southern border?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Rob, because the federal authorities have also looked at relocation as a way to help with overcrowded facilities. And they have considered plans, you know, internally within the Department of Homeland Security, for example, of how they could kind of effectively coordinate and move migrants to different regions that are a bit more north of the southern border towns. But that was something that was done, like you said, with coordination in mind. And it wasn't something that was made politically available as any kind of political statement or symbolic politics. So it's sort of different in that way. But the idea of coordination, I think, is what's really key, as well as the idea of deception, the extent to which there seems to have been an element of deception in enticing the migrants to board the chartered planes, and even with Governor Abbott in previous months enticing some of them to board the buses, sending them to New York or Washington, D.C. or Chicago. So I think that's what's really key. And if we're looking at the legality, we're going to need to get more info on how much these migrants were promised versus what the reality was when they arrived.
Right. There are going to be legal challenges, it looks like, from lawyers stepping up to represent the migrants. On that very issue of consent to be moved here and the idea that they were deceived, I think we're going to discover new interesting points of American law. What is your read on that issue and how important the question of deception is here?
Yeah, it is a really murky gray area because human trafficking itself usually involves coerced or, you know, lured under false pretenses, but for the intent of some sort of commercial gain, whether it's labor exploitation, sexual exploitation. And in this case, I doubt they will be able to produce evidence of that kind of intent since it's more about the political statement of it. But there is that commonality of deception or luring them under false pretenses. So there may be more of a basis for something like deprivation of liberty or fraud. So these kinds of lawsuits that the migrants themselves would file are more likely, I think, to gain traction for criminal charges than anything the Democratic lawmakers are proposing in pressuring the Department of Justice. I think it would really need to unfold from the migrants themselves as the clients, kind of saying they were lured and they would not have given their consent to board those planes if they realized where they were going and that there were not really job and housing and schooling opportunities where they were headed.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pete is with us now in Marinette. Pete, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just find it interesting that none of these points were brought up until these people were sent to Democrat-leaning and liberal cities, right? I still believe this is a pure case of not in my backyard. These places like Texas and Arizona are overrun by these people, and all of the resources there are stretched to the limit. They don't have the jobs. They don't have the police. They don't have the medical care, none of that stuff. You see these people dying, trying to cross over. They're dying in the deserts because we can't handle the influx. But nobody seemed to really get up in arms until it started going to the Democrat areas. So I'm curious how you can explain to me how this is not a case of just simply not in my backyard.
Pete, thanks for the call. Elise, what do you think?
Yeah, well, Pete actually raises some really important points about the double standards, even with Democratic policymakers. And he's right that Democrats themselves tend to be a little more quiet when we look at the federal policies of something very similar to what DeSantis has done, because DeSantis said, well, I've sent people into Texas to intercept them before they can arrive on the territory of Florida, right? To then intercept their journey and reroute them so they don't come to Florida state territory. Well, the U.S. as a federal entity has been doing that for decades, since the 1990s with Prevention Through Deterrence, intercepting migrants, as the caller, as Pete mentioned, in the deserts or in the sea areas, pushing them out away from U.S. territory so they can't make it to U.S. territory to claim asylum. So there is that hypocrisy, and that including Democratic members of Congress and Democratic presidents, that's actually just been a national policy we've had for a long time. But liberal groups have often pointed that out, and I think migrant advocacy groups have been pointing that out for a while. It just hasn't gotten as much attention.
Thanks for the call, Pete. We're talking to Elise Cohen, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Green Bay, with us to talk about why some Republican governors have been busing or flying migrants to Democratic cities in the north. Questions about whether the practice is legal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to all of this? What do you want to know about the rights migrants do and don't have when they enter the U.S.? Do you want to see more sanctuary cities defined in various ways across the country? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk about immigration and why some southern governors are sending migrants by bus or plane to cities in the north. Elise Cohen stays with us at UW-Green Bay. You can join in with your reactions to this news story, your questions about it, what you'd like to see change, if anything, on U.S. immigration policy, especially at the southern border. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Oshkosh. Chris, hello.
Chris, hello.
Yes, good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Chris?
Yeah, when I, it's readily apparent to me and just about everyone I speak to of both political stripes that our economy in the United States is completely dependent on, I don't know what term to use politically correct, the guest workers, alien workers, you know what I mean. I'm not sure what to call it.
Sure.
For decade after decade, president after president of both parties, this has been a third rail of American politics. Nobody is willing to address the problem. The problem, as I see it, is that an awful lot of these foreign workers are operating under false credentials, working for people, drawing a paycheck in a very conventional fashion. This means they're paying into Social Security. That is money that they will never see back. So we have 10 million odd workers who are contributing and making a false increase in the level of Social Security funding. That makes it very, very prickly for our government to find a way to legitimize these workers and still protect Social Security. Your thoughts?
Chris, thanks for the call. Elise?
Yeah, Chris is right that the economy is very much dependent on this kind of labor market. And this is why I think for people that are really focused on solving immigration as a policy problem, and for a long time in the early 2000s, there was bipartisan support. How can we create legal pathways for people to have the temporary residency, for people to meet sort of rise and fall of labor demand? And what we saw was really after the rise of the Tea Party during the Obama administration, there was a big shift where it was no longer about the kind of practical aspects that Chris is bringing up in terms of the policy solutions, but it was really more about the politics of it and what each party is purporting to stand for, and really refusal to compromise over things like he's saying with how we could address the economic side of this. So I think that's what really does get lost, is we don't have these kind of very pragmatic discussions of what's best for the economy on the policy side. It's really much more about political messaging and symbolism and the identity around immigration issues.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Mike joins us now in Shorewood. Mike, hi.
Hi, everyone. I appreciate the show today. I guess my comment is more about racializing or scapegoating, you know, people of color. I just wonder, you know, if this was Ukrainian refugees or asylees, how this just wouldn't happen. Of course, that Santos and these other governors are using, you know, people from South America or from Mexico to sort of make these political points. And my last comment would just be, we can handle the numbers, and I agree with the other callers that, you know, if we can handle 15,000 Afghan refugees in Wisconsin and get them, you know, moved around the country, we should be able to find the political will to do this. Thank you.
Thanks for that call. Lisa, to that first point, what do you think of Mike's argument that this is especially targeting people from Latin American backgrounds?
Yeah, the racialized aspect is really crucial. I should mention that when Senator Ted Cruz introduced the Stop the Surge Act last year, he did that right after, if listeners remember, last fall of 2021, there was the large arrival of thousands of Haitian asylum seekers and migrants under that bridge in Del Rio, Texas. And so it was really in the shadow of that very specific concern about Haitians that Cruz introduced the legislation. And we also need to give credit, of course, to former President Trump, who actually was the one to first propose busing migrants to liberal sanctuary cities. In 2018 and 2019, he was advocating very much for that and using a lot of that racialized language that Mike is mentioning around Central American asylum seekers as a threat or as related to criminality and gangs. So yeah, we really cannot untether this from the way people see who these immigrants are and why they see them as threatening in their communities.
Thanks for that call. Scott is with us now in Milton. Scott, hello.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I can't be more proud of Governor Ron DeSantis and Craig Abbott. I think the first time the Republican Party is actually punching up and not letting themselves getting steamrolled, and they're bringing the issue to the Democrats' front door, literally doing it. And by doing that, it's exposing this issue of immigration, and Democrats are allowing immigration to be an issue that's touched on at the heart, and it's supposed to make you feel for these people, and I do. And I'd love to see our immigration system be reformed to make it streamlined, but as much as the Democrats have let down their voters, and they have not passed any sweeping legislation to make this problem easier, it's just been an executive issue, and allowing the Biden administration to pass to be able to open their borders and want to bring these people in just because they're seeking asylum and they want a better life. And as much as I want to see them improve their life, they need to go through it in a legal manner.
Scott, thanks for the call. To that last point, Elise, what are the options for doing, as Scott says, seeking a better life in a legal manner? How accessible is that?
Yeah, I think that Scott's bringing up this point where even liberals within the Democratic Party have sort of pushed back on the fact that the Biden administration hasn't really come through on a lot of the policy promises around helping ease the journey from asylum to legal status. We did see an attempt to halt Title 42 that was just immediately expelling people, even preventing them from having their asylum interviews at the southern border. However, that policy has been kept in place due to federal court injunctions. So there's a lot of frustration even among Democrats. And then you can hear Scott really is connecting with a Republican message, sort of standing up to that hypocrisy within Democrats. And Governor Abbott said something very similar, that he believes these relocation efforts really, quote, take the border to Biden. So I think that it's a moment where we could see some Republicans and Democrats might come together in being critical of Biden. But for the most part, Democrats are much more focused on the migrants being used as political pawns in this moment. So I think that part of the conversation will probably be a bit delayed until these migrants' needs are met more immediately.
Scott, thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Daisy is with us in Madison. Daisy, hello.
Hi there. I'm calling in, I guess, just with hoping for some clarification. I'm a teacher. I work with students and many families who are coming in, and they have come in legally. They're waiting for court dates that are sometimes backed up 2 years. And I have students who are hoping to apply for colleges or hoping to get a license, and they don't have the documentation they need to do so, or to rent an apartment, for example. And I'm wondering if you could help me understand the root behind this problem. Is it the fact that courts are moving slowly, or there's not enough people to process paperwork? And then if there's any other resources I can be pointing students to, I just feel like I would love to have more information to help these families move forward with their lives and not have to wait 2 years to potentially get a license, rent an apartment, apply for it.
Gotcha. Daisy, we just have a little over a minute left. Elise, what would you tell Daisy?
I think for Daisy's question, one of the biggest root causes is the backlog in the court cases. There's about 1.9 million pending court cases in the U.S. immigration courts. So hiring more judges, finding a way to invest more resources into that process would be key. And then if Daisy's looking for some resources, Voces de la Frontera is really active in Wisconsin for providing information on how to help with some of those possible student needs that Daisy's working with.
Daisy. Thanks for that call. And Elise, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Elise Cohen, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. She's with us today to talk about Republican governors sending migrants to cities controlled by Democrats. Questions over the goals of that tactic and the legality of it. Still time for you to share your thoughts. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, what issues are most important to you in the upcoming election? A new public opinion project wants to find out. We'll learn more about the Main Street agenda and its efforts to hear from and meet with voters around Wisconsin. You can get us started right now. What do you wish you heard candidates talking more about, the media talking more about as we get closer and closer to Election Day? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.